for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Alex Haley once said, "In all of us there is a hunger, marrow deep, to know our heritage, to know who we are, and where we have come from." Millions of Americans, including myself, trace their American heritage back to Ellis Island. Author Vincent Canato details the history of this tiny island, from hosting pirate hangings in the 1800s to its heyday as America's main immigration station a century later. His new book is titled American Passage. Author Vincent Canato joins me in the studio. I know many of you share with me that heritage, that part of your family has come through Ellis Island or indeed some other port, but in the early 20th century, that was the place. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Vincent Canato, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
And I gather your own family begins here in America, in Ellis Island.
Yeah, on my father's side, I've got my grandfather, great-grandfather, great-granduncles, or granduncles, however they may be, came through Ellis Island. On my mother's side, she's a more modern immigrant. She's a JFK immigrant coming through the airport.
I see. Yeah. And in what years would your grandfather have come?
He came over in the first decade of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I also think that another great-grandfather came over probably through Castle Garden, which was the predecessor of Ellis Island, probably in the 1880s.
Tell me about Ellis Island, what it looks like, what it looked like when it was in its heyday, and what individuals coming through experienced.
Sure. Today, if you were to go there, it's about 20-some-odd acres, but most of that is filled in land. The original island was less than 3 acres. It was just this tiny little outcropping in New York Island. It really wasn't very much to look at. So over the years, they filled in more. There's a couple of dozen buildings on the island today. It's kind of like an E-shaped island if you look at it from above. What most people see today is the north part of the island, the main building. That's where they go to. But on the south side of the island, there's the old medical facilities, which are really not open to the public now. They haven't been renovated.
So, say, back in the early 20th century, what would happen to an individual arriving at Ellis Island?
They'd come up, if you're familiar with the geography of New York, they'd come up through the Narrows between Staten Island and Brooklyn. There, the ship would stop. They'd be boarded by immigration officials who would then inspect first and second class passengers. Remember, it's sort of there's first, second, sometimes third, and then steerage. And they'd inspect the first and second class passengers. And that would be their main inspection.
Inspection for what?
Largely at the stage for disease, and just to see if they were maybe prostitutes or something like that. Then the ship would head to Manhattan and dock in Manhattan, because the steamships could not land in the pier at Ellis Island. It was just too shallow. So the boats would land in Manhattan. The immigrants would get off. First and second class passengers could then leave. They would not have to go through Ellis Island unless there was something wrong, like they were sick or there was something wrong with their paperwork. So really, Ellis Island is, for the most part, for third class and steerage passengers. They would then get on a ferry, and that would take them to Ellis Island.
And then what would happen?
Well, then they'd get off, and then their inspection process would begin. They would make their way into the main building, and they would form lines. This was what was called the line inspection. And they would be kind of paraded past doctors and inspectors who would then, in a mere matter of seconds, have to sort of make a diagnosis. Were they muttering to themselves? Were they limping? Were they have a hunchback? Were they blind? They would have to make this quick sort of judgment. And about 20% of those people would be put aside for further inspection.
How did Americans feel at the time about Ellis Island as the gateway to America. How did Americans feel about those coming in?
There are many Americans who are concerned about the people coming in. They thought that too many of them were what were called undesirables. They were worried that a lot of immigrants were coming. These new immigrants were from Southern and Eastern Europe. They were Jews. They were Catholics. They were from what were called at the time inferior races. So there was a great deal of fear among Americans that this new group of immigrants were going to somehow harm America.
Harm America by simply being here.
Yeah. I mean, this is the time, this is really the beginning of what was called eugenics. So the idea that these are genetically inferior people and they will then transmit these genes to future generations and kind of lower the overall gene pool of America. These were people who weren't going to assimilate. These were people who were Catholics, which was a hierarchical religion, which was not compatible with democracy. I mean, there are all these fears that were kind of bubbling around.
It's fascinating to me that Ellis Island was once known as a place where criminals and pirates were hanged.
Yeah, this is in the early 19th century. The island was owned by the federal government, and there's still piracy at the time. And a number of pirates are captured. They're tried. It's a federal crime, and they're sentenced to be executed. And they choose Ellis Island, what was at this time was called Gibbet Island, because the gibbet is where they kind of hang the dead body to kind of show. There was great morality play about these hangings. And it was a public spectacle. People came by boat to watch these hangings.
Vincent Canato, his new book is titled American Passage, The History of Ellis Island. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. How did New York become that entryway into the U.S.?
Yeah, during this period of time, probably around 75% of immigrants coming to America came through New York, came through Ellis Island. It's the biggest port in the country. And, immigration is tied to commerce, tied to shipping lines. So with most ships coming in to New York, most immigrants are going to come in and be filtered in through New York. Boston is probably a distant second in terms of port. You've got Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, San Francisco. But New York, again, probably at least 75%.
Now, what requirements were there for these immigrants coming through?
Congress makes very clear the list of categories for which an immigrant could be excluded. And the categories, and this was written into law by Congress, included idiots, imbeciles, people likely to become a public charge, prostitutes, anarchists, people with loathsome or dangerous diseases, people who were guilty of crimes of moral turpitude. These were all the categories that Congress laid out. And it was up to the officials at Ellis Island and other ports to decide, okay, did an immigrant, did they come under one of these categories? If they did, then they were not allowed to enter the country.
Did those coming in have to have someone here who would sponsor them, who would make sure that they had enough money, for example?
Not at this time. The idea of sponsorship will come later. There was no sponsorship. You could simply arrive, and as long as you didn't, you were healthy enough and didn't come under these classifications, you were allowed to enter. Women, though, single women were not allowed to leave Ellis Island by themselves. They had to be escorted by a male relative or a member of an immigrant aid society. The fear was that these women might be taken advantage of by pimps and be lured into lives of prostitution.
Did they have to have a certain amount of money in their own pockets?
Growing up, I heard from my grandfather that you had to have $25 to come into America. And in researching the book, I found out where that came from. There was never any law that said you had to have X amount of money. But one of the commissioners at Ellis Island, William Williams, who wants stricter enforcement of the laws, says, well, how do we decide who's likely to become a public charge? Well, an immigrant has to have at least $25 on them. If they don't have $25, we're going to inspect them. We're going to, you know, have a further inspection and investigation of them. That only lasted a couple of months. And then officials in Washington say, hey, look, no, that's actually not the law. But immigrants hear about this in Europe, and they say, okay, you want to get through? You want to come to America?
You've got
to have to have the $25.
Yeah. Now, what was the immigration experience before Ellis Island?
It was also in New York, the main sort of inspection station. It was called Castle Garden, but it was run by the state of New York along with immigrant aid societies. So that's a little bit different. Most immigration policy was done at the state level. And what Ellis Island represents in many ways is the federal government then taking control of the issue of immigration, saying, we're going to regulate it. We're not going to leave it up to individual states.
And when did that begin?
In the 1880s, the federal government begins to sort of take control. And then the early 1890s is when the federal government takes complete control.
So you're saying that prior to that time, individuals coming to this country could go into other states?
Well, yeah. I mean, they would come through Boston. They would come through New York. But it was the responsibility of the states. The states wrote the laws. And they said, you know, no paupers, no one with a disease. You know, they ran the inspection station, the hospitals for the immigrants. And that was it was up to the states. But the belief was that the states weren't doing a good job. They weren't doing a good enough job. And so it was up to the federal government to really be the regulator of immigrants. And this kind of parallels what's going on in the economy. You know, there's the idea of economic regulation was left up to the states before this largely. And now in the 1880s, 1890s, the federal government says, no, you know, we're going to pass antitrust laws. We're going to, you know, pass these other laws that's going to regulate private business.
Vincent Canato. And his book about the immigration experience at Ellis Island is titled American Passage. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And welcome back. Vincent Canato is with me. He's written a book about the immigration experience and the history of Ellis Island. His new book is titled American Passage. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Here's an email from Gerald in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He says, thanks to the Mormons, we now have internet access to Ellis Island immigrant records. Do any other databases exist for immigrants arriving before or after Ellis Island?
That's a good question. Yeah, it is thanks to the Mormons who did tremendous work to put all this stuff online. And you can go online and search for your ancestors, which you'll be searching of the ship manifests, which is the main listing for these immigrants. For those after, I'm not entirely sure what you can do. I'm not quite sure. For beforehand, I know some of the records burned. There was a fire at Ellis Island. Some of the earlier records for immigrants burned. But I think that there are ship records for the 19th century that can be found at the National Archives. So that's, I think, what you would want to do. How extensive they are, I'm not sure. I really haven't done work in those.
But the website to find one's relatives at, if you know that they came through Ellis Island, is what?
www.ellisislandrecords.org, and you can go, it's a searchable database. You can search variations of the name. You can search by port that they left from. You can search by year. You can search by the name of the ship. If you have any kind of information, it's a very well done search engine.
And here's an email from Diane in Washington, D.C., who says, for Chinese immigrants to the U.S., from approximately 1905 to 1940, Angel Island in San Francisco Bay was the place. It was also a cruel detention center. What do you know about it, Vincent?
Yeah, Angel Island was the inspection center at San Francisco, and most of the immigrants they dealt with were Chinese immigrants. The policy for Chinese immigrants was very different from the policy towards European immigrants, immigrants from the Middle East, immigrants from the Caribbean. What we had beginning in the 1880s was a Chinese law banning almost all Chinese immigrants. So
why? On what basis?
Two bases. One was a racial basis. These people were just deemed racially different, they would not be able to assimilate, and the other was a labor issue, that the fear by workers, unions, that Chinese workers were being imported and driving down wages and taking jobs.
And our emailer asks, how does it compare, that is Angel Island, how does Angel compare to Ellis in the number of immigrants processed?
Oh, far more at Ellis Island. But I sort of look at Ellis Island as a sieve. It's a sifting mechanism to sift out the quote-unquote undesirables from the desirables. And by and large, 98% of immigrants are allowed to land. Angel Island is a much more restrictive place. I mean, it's really there to sort of keep out Chinese immigrants. So it has a much different, as the writer said, it's a much crueler, more of a punitive measure. It's not, people don't look on Angel Island today with great nostalgia. Chinese immigrants don't look at it with nostalgia. Mm.
And here's an email from Francis, who says, I've read that Ellis Island facilities were closed during 1917 and 18. Is that true? And if so, where did immigrants enter the country?
Yeah, I don't think it was officially closed. Those are the war years, World War I years. For the most part, the U.S. military takes over Ellis Island during those years, or most of the island. It's used for wounded soldiers to recuperate. It's kind of a way station for other soldiers and seamen who are headed over to Europe during the war. So immigration itself goes down to very, very little during the war years. There's not a lot of immigrants being processed there.
All right. We have a number of callers. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi there, Janice. You're on the air.
Hello. My grandfather came from England to Canada in 1912. I grew up with the understanding that he was on the first ship after the Titanic, and his plan had been to go to Australia, but he ran out of money and only got as far as Montreal. My question is, how did people decide whether or not they were going to come to Canada or the U.S.?
That's a good question. One of the things that made the decision was where they had friends and family. People often went to places where they already either had family members or friends from the old town, so they would gravitate there. Another reason is some people did not come to New York, to Ellis Island. They went to Canada or other countries because they feared they might not make it through the inspection process.
Was Canada's less rigorous than that at the U.S.?
I think so, yeah, at the time. And certainly Argentina was as well. Although Argentina has its own Ellis Island down there, which is quite a bit different from our Ellis Island. It's sort of a hotel. But I know one of my, I think my grandfather's brother went to Argentina.
Interesting.
So you had people, it's important to remember that this immigration, as the caller says, is not just simply from Europe to America, it's from Europe to Canada, to South America, to Australia. There's a great worldwide migration going on during this time.
I hope that answers it, Janice.
Yes, I have one more question.
Surely.
What years were people coming to Ellis Island? When did it start and end, I guess?
Well, 1892 it opens, and Ellis Island itself is open until 1954, but the heyday ends in the 1920s when Congress passes a series of restrictive quota laws, which put quotas on individual countries. They also create the system that we have today, the visa system, so that immigrants no longer went through an inspection station here in America as much. Instead, they went to get a visa at the American consulate in their own country.
And now to Cleveland, Ohio. Hi there, Roberta. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Ellis Island, very near and dear to my heart. I have a sweet little story. My mother came through Ellis Island in 1919, and in 1989, I took her back to visit. I had a handheld tape recorder, and she spoke into it, and she was very exuberant and explained everything. And before it was over, we had a crowd of people around her, and there were people asking her questions, tell me about this and tell me about that. And one other thing she said came from Russia after the pogroms, terrible life. She said, it's the only place where people said good morning to me.
Isn't that a wonderful story? Thanks for sharing that with us. I hope you keep that tape forever.
I will.
Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. There is another side to Ellis Island, and that is the amount of corruption that began to appear. What happened?
Well, in the 19th century, even as today, there's a great deal of patronage, and that's what it's the lifeblood of politics. And Ellis Island was a bit of a patronage pit. The people who worked there got their jobs at the beginning largely through political connections. So what you had was, you know, a less than stellar group of individuals working there. There was some petty corruption, people taking bribes to get immigrants through.
The inspectors.
Inspectors, yeah, and other kind of officials working there. There was one case of a immigration official there who was accused of molesting women, basically, in the inspection process, speaking to them crudely and so forth. So in the 1890s, there were investigations and accusations. It was, and also partly during this time, there is no Ellis Island. It burns down, and for a couple of years, they're over in Lower Manhattan. So in the 1890s, it was a bit of a mess.
And fake certificates and the like?
I've seen a couple of cases of that a little bit later on, people coming in under different names. But that was the one case I saw was someone getting around the immigration quotas of the 20s.
And then finally, it's brought to the attention of Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, Roosevelt really, he is interested in immigration. He's always been since he was a very young man. And he comes in and he wants to fix Ellis Island. He knows there's a problem. He wants to fix it. It takes him a little bit of a while.
What is it he specifically wants to fix?
Well, he wants to fix the corruption. That's the main thing. He wants to weed out the corruption, the patronage people, anyone there who's corrupt. And he wants to put in good, honest, men at the time who worked there, who will, uphold the law and not do it for, private interest, lining their pockets.
So how does he do this? How does he enact this kind of federal control?
Well, he fires the top two people there. He fires the person who's in charge of immigration in Washington, a man named Terence Powderly, who was a pretty famous American. He was a labor leader. He helped to found the Knights of Labor. And he installs his own man at Ellis Island, a man named William Williams, who is a kind of old-line, patrician, wealthy New York Republican lawyer who sets about cleaning up the station. Mm-hmm. But he has some other ideas about immigration as well.
All right, to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Diane.
My question to you is this. I am visiting next week, and I was on the website this morning and could not find any information. My grandparents came from Lithuania probably late 1800s, early 1900s. My father was first born here in 1907. Their name is totally different everywhere I go. The name that his birth name was Mitchell. But their name in Lithuania was Misevičius. He said they changed it at Ellis Island because they couldn't speak English. Would this be true?
That's one of the it's a very common story that we have. Mm-hmm. That's largely not true. Although everyone has heard it. You know, everyone, so many people, their ancestors have told them this, their parents have told them this. The thing is that inspectors at Ellis Island were working off the ship's manifests, so the names were already written down, the information was already written down. This was not a place where they took names of people and gave names of people. I think most of these name changes occurred either when they when the ship companies in Europe wrote down the names on the ship's manifests, or it happened after Ellis Island when immigrants went to fill out paperwork to become naturalized. And also, a lot of immigrants changed their names themselves to Americanize, to Anglicize their names. So, but it's a very, very common story. I mean, my last name is actually Kanata with an A. Somehow the A got turned into an O. I have no idea. But no, it was not the idea that Ellis Island immigrants were handing out names is a bit of a misconception.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I won't be able to find them, probably, but...
Well, good luck to you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to St. Louis, Missouri at 27 before the hour. And to remind, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Good morning, Gretchen. You're in St. Louis.
Good morning, Diane. You are so gifted.
Oh, thank you.
First of all, I'm Sicilian heritage. My maternal and paternal grandparents came to Ellis Island on steerage, 19 days on this old, old freighter. And my little Sicilian grandparents were only 5 foot, and they didn't speak a word of English. My poor little Nana was detained because she was so sick, was seasick, and morning sickness. And they were sponsored by the youngest of the family who came to America, worked, and paid for them to come over. And they immigrated to Omaha because of Union Pacific. And then they raised, each of them had 7 children, both maternal and paternal, all successful. And my little grandparents on my mother's side would practice with a pencil and paper how to spell their names, which were changed when they came through. They all had paper tags pinned on them in Ellis Island. And it was fantastic how they made their way. Mm. Never a complaint. Bless God every day. Mm. And a real quick item. My brother works for the State of California Historical Restoration, and he spent 5 months on Ellis Island Angel Island, restoring the island, and he had so many stories, even in reconstructing it, found old documents. Fantastic. That's all I wanted to say, and thank you for the show today.
Gretchen, I'm so glad you called. Thank you. Any comment, Vince?
No, I mean, this. You can definitely hear from so many of these callers the emotional attachment that so many Americans have to Ellis Island. I mean, this is part, Ellis Island has become part of their family history, and it's part of my family's history and part of so many. The estimates are some 40% of Americans can trace one ancestor back to Ellis Island, and that's a lot of people.
You really uncovered some fascinating stories. I'm thinking of Vera Cathcart, who arrived in 1926. Tell us about her.
Well, Vera Cathcart was actually not even an immigrant. She was a tourist. And one thing we don't realize is that these immigration laws also apply to tourists. Tourists, people visiting the country, could also be rejected, be turned away. So Vera Cathcart is a British woman. She's Lady Cathcart. She's married into kind of minor nobility. And she comes to America because she has a play that she wants to sell and put on. And when she gets here, she marks off the fact that she's divorced. Well, as it turns out, she was divorced because she'd had an affair with a gentleman before. It had become news. So somehow immigration officials find out about this and they detain her and they say, you committed adultery. This is a crime of moral turpitude. So we're not going to let you in. So she's detained and it becomes a big, you know, international issue. You have women's groups in America who are charging that this is a sexual double standard because actually the guy that she had an affair with was also married, and he happened to be in the States. He was in New York already. He had gotten in. When immigration officials find out that he's in, they threaten to detain him, and he kind of flees to Canada, to the Ritz-Carlton in Canada. So, yeah, so she's, you know, people in England don't understand this. This is like typical Puritan Americans, sexually obsessed. You know, what do they care about this stuff? So eventually she is allowed to land. She while she's detained, she writes another play, which is a kind of a autobiographical account of her stay at Ellis Island. And they put on her play here in D.C. It gets panned. She does a little bit of acting in it. She gets panned, and she ends up going back to England.
Just giving up on this country altogether.
Although she said that the people at Ellis Island were nicer than the critics.
Vincent Canato, this new book he's written is all about the history of Ellis Island. It's titled American Passage. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed at aecf.org. By the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Gruber Family Foundation, to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Immigration remains a hot-button issue across the U.S., but the personal stories of many of today's newcomers illustrate how they contribute to America's strength. What it means to be an immigrant in the U.S. today, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we always know when there's a question asked, someone is out there to provide an answer. We've heard from Marion, who is the branch chief at the U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services. She says a caller asked about records before and after Ellis Island. Before, she says, see the National Archives at www.archives.gov. After, see the archives and or USCIS at www.uscis.gov/genealogy. all these wonderful sources.
Yeah, no, it's great. And Marion Smith, the person who sent it, is a resource in and of herself. She helped out tremendously with the book.
I'm so glad. Here is an email from Plymouth, New Hampshire. And New Hampshire, Teresa writes, "My grandfather was a chaplain at Ellis Island in the early 1920s. He learned enough Armenian, Greek, and other languages while there to enable him to move to Jerusalem and minister and teach there. Is there any place that the stories of the staff at Ellis Island is recorded?"
Well, in this book, I do try to discuss staff members in there, mostly commissioners, some doctors, some other officials who were there. No, there's not, to the best of my knowledge, there's not a lot of material. There are some oral histories that we have of immigrants, and then some oral histories of some people who did work there. You know, I found articles written at the time by doctors and others who had worked there, so I was able to kind of reconstruct that. But there's not like one database of people who worked there. But the people at Ellis Island might have, they have oral histories, interviews there, and they have some people who worked there. So you might want to check with the people at Ellis Island and see if, you know, see if her relative is listed there.
All right. And of course, those websites I gave to you, we will certainly have on our own website, drshow.org. Let's go now to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Larry. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning, Diane. I had the most incredible story to tell you.
Good.
I have an uncle who, when he was 11 years old, lived in a Jewish shtetl in Russia. His parents were constantly frightened for him because of the constant pogroms they had there. A caravan came through that shtetl, and they gave a lot of money to some people in that shtetl to bring my uncle, who was 11 years old at the time, down to the Mediterranean and somehow smuggle him on a ship to America. When they got to the Mediterranean, they found a Jewish family who, for a fee, was willing to take part in this ruse. And he got on a ship with them as their son. He got through Ellis Island, and when they came finally to Manhattan, these people were picked up by friends and left this 11-year-old boy alone on the streets of Manhattan. He walked through the streets for days until he found an area that had Jewish writing on the stores. So he figured this must be a safe place. They don't kill Jews here. He sat on a bench for a couple of days, and a Jewish tailor from a tailor shop saw him. He approached the boy, and he asked him, "What are you doing here?" And my uncle told him the story. He took him into the shop, taught him how to sew and be a tailor, let him sleep in the back. In a few years, he got a job at a sweatshop, working, making garments, where he met my aunt, married her, and became my uncle. His name was Nathan, and he was the greatest man I ever knew.
Well, Larry, I can really hear how emotionally attached you were to your uncle, and it was, as you said, a wonderful story. How many were literally smuggled on?
Hard to say, but the caller's story is I mean, it's a very moving one, an emotional one, but it tells a few things. An 11-year-old boy just simply couldn't show up, would not be allowed to leave Ellis Island. So that's why I think they had to have the ruse that these were his, quote-unquote, parents.
Right.
Otherwise, he couldn't have landed. And there was also the idea, a lot of people who were anti-immigrant at the time complained that immigration was artificial. It was people were paying immigrants in Europe to come on over. And there was a little bit of that, as you said. There were some Jewish groups. There were steamship companies that were kind of encouraging people to come across. But for the most part, most people came across because they either wanted to flee the pogroms or they wanted to come for better opportunities.
Here's an email from Josh. What would happen to immigrants who were rejected from being allowed in?
It's a sad story. They would be sent back. You know, a lot of these people had sold all their life's belongings. They had probably sold their homes or farms, whatever they had in Europe. So when they got back, it would be very tough for them.
But how would they pay for passage back?
And that's a very good point. In the law, the U.S. government gave the responsibility to pay for the passage back to the steamship companies. So steamship companies had a financial stake in the fact that everyone, or you know, whoever they sold tickets to, they thought would make it through. So they had their own inspection process in Europe, in the ports in Europe. Steamship companies would put immigrants through an inspection process. And if they didn't think an immigrant would make it through to America, they would not sell them a ticket.
But if they did have to take them back, I'm sure they wouldn't treat them very well.
You know, I'm sure they didn't get first-class treatment over
exactly.
there. But I did come across some a story of Russian Jewish immigrants who would be sent back, had a very tough time at the border because the Russians weren't very excited about having them back in Russia.
Let me ask you about Cipriano Castro.
Well, he was the head of Venezuela for a while, strong man in Latin America. And he goes to Europe for some medical treatment, and he basically gets deposed. So he wants to come to America and then make his way back down, and he is detained at Ellis Island. He's actually comes to Ellis Island two separate times, but he's detained because the argument is that he had been involved in a political assassination back in Venezuela. So this came under the broad category of crime of moral turpitude. So he's detained there, and there's a big kind of debate, investigation. Was he part of this? And he had never been convicted in any court of this. So ultimately, he was allowed to land, and then he made his way down, I think, to Puerto Rico, I think is where he went. But he had very nice accommodations at Ellis Island. He was treated fairly well.
But someone else who spent almost 3 years detained at Ellis Island in the 1950s, Ignaz Mazay. Who was he?
Yeah, there are actually two cases in the 50s that of immigrants detained that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Ignaz Mazay, who was a Hungarian immigrant, had been living in the United States but had not become a naturalized citizen. He goes back to Hungary to, I think, visit his dying mother, then comes back to Ellis Island and he's detained there. And the reason
he's not a citizen.
So yeah. You know, had he been a citizen,
right.
Then he'd be fine.
Yeah.
And the reason was it was argued that he was a communist. These were the 1950s, that he had taught communist ties. He is detained there. They want to send him back, but the problem is they don't know what his real citizenship is. Apparently he was born on a ship in the Mediterranean. So they want to send him back to England. England won't take him. They want to send him to France. France won't take him. They want to send him to Hungary. Hungary won't take him. He petitions every country in Latin America. None of them will take him. So he is a man without a country. He's stuck at Ellis Island. America won't take him, and no other country will take him. So the case goes all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, well, no, the government's within its rights to detain him, that they're not actually detaining him. He's free to leave any way he wants. He just can't leave to America.
Wow.
But he eventually is allowed to land.
Okay. To Dearborn, Michigan, Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. I haven't read your book, but I do have a couple exceptions. When my family immigrated here back in before the 20s and the teens, my great-grandfather had informed me that the immigration officials were surly, and that, you know, because just wave after wave, you know, people kept showing up. So that a lot of times these people were pressured, even in our case, to change our names to something that the officials could actually pronounce, because they were just getting so many different, languages in there. And then I talked to some of my Polish friends, and they said the same thing had happened to them at Ellis. Now, it didn't happen. I'm not sure the port in Windsor there was or in Canada, because I know when my grandfather was my great grandfather went back to Malta, married a Maltese girl, and then when they came back, my grandfather actually was born on the way over. So when he landed in Canada, they didn't make him change his name, but his brother, when he immigrated and landed at Ellis, they made him change his name.
Isn't that interesting?
That they could work with.
Yeah.
Well, they were certainly, I mean, I don't deny that the immigration officials were surly. I mean, these are people dealing with, you know, thousands on a given day, people coming through. Some of them were not terribly sympathetic to immigrants. Some of them were overworked. Many of them were overworked. So it's not like immigrants got a big Welcome to America banner when they showed up. I mean, that's not what was going on here. It was not a huge welcoming place. It was, you know, immigrants were treated like cattle. I mean, they tried to treat them as humanely as possible, but, you know, it was not done for the benefit of immigrants. That's not what this was for.
Thanks for your call, Michael. Here's an email with a two-part question. First, when did the quota restrictions begin? This is from Diana in Rochester, New York.
The first quota comes in 1921, then there's another quota, 1924, that's stricter, and then in the late 20s, there's the final quota, which is also was just as stricter as well. So the 1920s is the period when quotas come into effect.
And second, where can I get a list of the numbers of immigrants currently allowed into the U.S. from all other countries? How and who decides those numbers?
That's a good question. First of all, I think the thing to do is to go to the website of the, it's not called the INS anymore. It's called ICE, Immigration Citizenship, I think. Now, if you go online, you should be able to find it's the federal government's, it's a government website. And they keep very extensive immigration statistics. You can download their recent report. It breaks it down by country. It breaks it down according to what category they entered in on. Mm-hmm. Today, we don't have the same laws as we did during Ellis Island. Today, to come to America, you have to come in under a certain category. And by and large, most immigrants who come in because of family connections, family ties to people who are already here. There are also smaller numbers of refugees, asylees, and high-skilled workers. But most of the people who come in because of family ties.
Now, your own father was actually born in this country.
Born here, yep.
Did he talk to his father a great deal about the immigration experience?
No,
I don't think they did.
And that's part of the story I get to towards the end of the book. In the 50s and 60s, you know, these people were busy. My family, others, they were busy assimilating into America, moving to the suburbs. You know, they didn't want to look backwards. They wanted to get away from the accents and the ethnic. That it wasn't cool to be ethnic as it is today. You know, it was, and it's not until, and you started off with the Alex Haley quote, it's really not until the 60s and 70s when all of a sudden ethnicity, multiculturalism, I mean, that's it becomes hot, it becomes in, and people start looking at their roots.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to J-Town, Kentucky. Good morning, J.C., you're on the air.
Thank you very much. My grandmother came over in the late 1890s, from Ireland, and she came off a farm, and she spoke Gaelic at the time, so she was in a real quandary when she got here. My question is politics. What was the political climate here in the States towards immigrants at that time? I'm sure they were probably trying to find industrial workers and other things, but I'm sure there were also nativists that were trying to keep them out. Can you speak to the politics in Congress nationally and also there in New York?
Yeah, no, I have a lot of that in the book. I'm very interested in the politics of immigration, and I think you're exactly right. You have, on the one hand, people, Americans, are interested in getting immigrants. Why? They're cheap and expensive labor. They're going to help fuel industrial jobs. And on the other side, you have people who are fearful of immigrants, who think for a wide array of reasons, because, you know, they don't speak English, they come from, you know, these quote-unquote inferior races, because they're Catholic, because they're Jewish, for all these reasons. So what you have is you have a real fight in Congress, you have a fight in the newspapers, you have a fight in New York over people who want to restrict immigration, you know, be more selective, and you have a fight between those immigrants, whether it's business interests or ethnic and immigrant groups themselves, who want to be less restrictive.
I hope that answers it, J.C.
Well, now people are losing, you know, their positions in government sometimes when they support immigration, and I was just curious if they had those drawn-out, you know, just knife fights in Congress like they do now, pretty much, to keep people in or out.
Oh, yeah. No, there are heated debates. You have, Henry Cabot Lodge, the senator from Massachusetts, who's the leading sort of anti-immigrant politician. You have other politicians from the Midwest, German-American congressmen and senators who are just as adamant on the other side. You have presidents like Teddy Roosevelt who are trying to find that balance between, he's best friends with Henry Cabot Lodge. He's friends with a lot of these Brahmin patricians who don't like the immigrants. But yet he also has a lot of immigrant friends in New York City. So he's constantly trying to balance these two out.
Thanks for calling, J.C. Ellis Island was closed 1954.
Correct.
Is that correct? It was left to rot. What happened?
Well, as we were saying before, I think people weren't that interested in looking backwards at the time. And it's the federal government didn't really know what to do with it. They were thinking about selling it. They wanted to sell it to private business. But then there was a little bit of an uproar at that, so they pulled back from it. And for a number of years, it was abandoned. Mother Nature and vandalism took its toll on the buildings. It was not in very good shape. It was overrun with kind of weeds. And it just stood there for a couple of decades.
And then what got the interest going again?
Well, I think part of it is this kind of revival of interest in ethnicity and roots that happens in the 60s and the 70s. People start saying, wait a second, let's look back at our ancestors. Let's see what they went through. So you have more people are interested. In the 70s, there's an attempt to kind of work on Ellis Island. And then in the 1980s, what you have is Lee Iacocca and the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation working with the federal government. And they raise money for both the restoration of the Statue of Liberty and for Ellis Island. And
how much did it
hundreds
cost?
Of millions. I mean, yeah. You know, you've got Lee Iacocca, who's a master salesman. I mean, yeah. He really, you know, he sells advertising. He's got corporate sponsorships. And it's an amazing story.
The history of Ellis Island. Vincent Canato, his book is titled American Passage. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
And we'll be taking a holiday to celebrate the 4th tomorrow. We'll bring you some golden oldies, and we'll be back with you live on Monday. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.